We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series
for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Sandy Butcher, Chief Executive of National FASD. FASD stands for Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder. Sandy is also a mum to a teen with FASD and served as a lay member of the NICE quality standard on FASD. I also have with me Rachel Jackson, who is a member of National FASD's Adult and Young Adults with FASD Advisory Committee. Rachel has long been an advocate for people with FASD and has appeared on national media and spoken in Parliament. Our podcast today coincides with FASD Awareness Month, which takes place in September. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Sandy and Rachel, welcome. Nice to meet you. Can you each introduce yourself and give a little detail about what you do and how you are involved in raising awareness of FASD?
I have the privilege of running the National Organization for FASD. And for people who don't know what that is, we are a charity that raises awareness of the risks of alcohol and pregnancy. And we also educate professionals and work with policymakers to try to ensure that there's best practice and good policies being followed about FASD. And most importantly, we support people with FASD and their families. We've just been doing quite a lot of work, I guess Rachel might tell you about it, on a Me and My FASD toolkit. So we're working with people with FASD to help others with FASD understand the diagnosis. National FASD, we also do training. We have an e-school. We have a new alcohol and pregnancy toolkit, lots of things. I'm also co-founder with my husband of the Hertfordshire area FASD support network. And as you said, maybe even most important of all, I'm mom to a wonderful teenager with FASD.
And Rachel, what can you tell us about yourself and your involvement with FASD?
My involvement, as Sandy has said, is, you know, we go into meetings and talk about what would have helped us at a young age and when we were in school. So like the games and that, the little cards and everything. And also going to sometimes training to, you know, help social workers and understand what it's like living with it. And also, as you mentioned,
you've done different national media, haven't you? You're on the BBC and
yes,
other interviews and spoke in Parliament.
Yes, that is true. I also wrote a piece when I was younger, and that has been sent around the world pretty much every year since I did it when I was 14. And that's when my story started with Sandy and FASD, because that's when I got to talk about the whole how it affected me and to talk to them about what they can do for the next generation.
So you're a young adult with FASD. How old are you? It might just be helpful to...
I am 20 years old.
Great, thank you very much. And I will ask you, Rachel, a little bit more later what it's like living with FASD, but I think it would be helpful to get just to describe some of the basics. So if I return to you, Sandy, can you explain what FASD is, how common is it, and how does it present?
FASD can result from alcohol-exposed pregnancies. Not every pregnancy that's alcohol-exposed will lead to FASD, but nobody out there can yet say which one will. The alcohol can affect the brain and the body as the fetus is developing, and it leads to lifelong challenges. Current diagnostic guidelines say that you have to have pervasive and longstanding brain dysfunction, which is defined by severe impairment in three or more neurodevelopmental areas. So the Department of Health has said that there's no mild FASD out there. I mean, we're really talking about lifelong brain damage and other parts of the body that can be affected as a result of the prenatal alcohol exposure. And so people with FASD need support through their lives, and the early recognition and diagnosis and support changes the trajectories. Without it, the stats can be really scary because it affects everything from motor skills to cognition, memory, you know, academic achievement, attention, language, adaptive behavior. And basically, the brain has trouble processing incoming information. And that can lead, as you, I'm sure your listeners know, to some profound difficulties if the people around them don't understand that. You asked about the prevalence. There's a study recently done by the University of Salford where they went into classrooms and they found that 2-4% of the students had FASD, but all of the ones that they found were undiagnosed. So that means we've got a neurodevelopmental condition out there that is mostly unrecognized and undiagnosed and unsupported.
I am going to ask you more about diagnosis, but I'm wondering about pregnancy and the use of alcohol. I don't know whether the amounts of alcohol are related to your chances of a child having FASD. And I'm wondering what the advice is, because advice to pregnant women around alcohol use has changed over the years. So what is the current advice?
Well, since 2016, the chief medical officers have been clear that the safest approach is to avoid alcohol if you're pregnant or if you could become pregnant. And that's because there's no proven safe amount of alcohol in pregnancy. And part of the reason why they can't do that kind of research to get in on this is it's so risky that there's no medical ethics board that'll approve doing this research, which should tell people listening that means it's an important thing. A lot of pregnancies are unplanned. A lot of women don't have the right information about what the risks are. And there are a lot of reasons why women drink alcohol in pregnancy. Maybe in those early months, they might not want others to know that they're pregnant. And there's a lot of social pressure in this country with pop culture rules. The message is that nobody should panic. The more you drink, the higher the chances are that the developing baby will be affected. But as I said, there's no proven safe amount. So if somebody has been drinking alcohol during pregnancy, whether they didn't know if they were pregnant or they thought it was safe, they should really have that discussion with their maternity team and get some support if they need help quitting. Any time in pregnancy that they stop quitting will always be better, because the brain develops throughout the pregnancy and is vulnerable throughout the pregnancy. If you have trouble stopping, then you need to get help from a specialist service who can work with you on that.
Does it matter which trimester? I mean, if you find are there some trimesters that are more risky than others, or?
No, because the brain develops throughout the pregnancy and the brain is very vulnerable, it's meant, the advice is to avoid alcohol throughout the pregnancy. Earlier in the pregnancy, when the fetus is developing the bones and the facial features and all of that sort of, there can be some additional things that can happen. It's at each stage of the pregnancy, different parts of the fetus are growing and developing. So it used to be that although the discussion was around when people had certain facial features, but they now know, after having done more research on this, that those facial features only develop in a very early window, early in the pregnancy, and they are not a sign as to how the cognitive impact has happened. Because, for example, if maybe mom had morning sickness in the first trimester and wasn't drinking, but then started drinking later, the bones might not have been affected, but the brain development and the CNS development, central nervous system, could be impacted. So it's just safest. Why risk is how we phrase it.
Rachel, let's return to you then. So as a young person with FASD, can you tell us what it's like for you living with FASD?
So living with my condition, it is a challenge, because I'm always thinking, how am I acting around other people? I always feel like I have to fake who I am being. So if I'm out in public, I'm always kind of wearing a mask, because I know that if I show any signs of my disablement, I can kind of tell people just look at me in a weird way, and it kind of just makes me very uncomfortable. So going to on the trains or something, you know, I get very stressed if I miss my train or anything. I get like other people do, but that's heightened, because now I feel like I have failed what I was meant to do. Because growing up, going into schools, you could tell by the way teachers look at you, feel like you've disappointed them. Because then that's always put back in my mind. It's like, oh, just like when I was younger, you know, in a way they would kind of go, Rachel, come on, you need to do better than this. And even today, I will be probably in bed, because my brain is so overwhelmed and stimulated that I'll need to have just to recover the next few days. And even if I go for a long walk as well, all my joints will flare up, because I have queried hypermobility, and it's just the continuous, oh, what if I say something? Because I will admit I don't have a filter sometimes because of my brain damage. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't know that I said something wrong. I know that if I go out somewhere, like I said, I have to be very careful what I do, I guess, in a way. And I do worry about my future because there's not enough resources out there. So I said to had a conversation with my mum and said, what am I going to do when you go? Now that sounds quite a morbid fact, but I'm scared what will happen. I know by the time she probably goes, I'll be a lot older. And then hopefully by that time, there will be more resources. But that plays on my mind. I'm like, what am I going to do without my structure? Because if I didn't have my daily structure, I probably would either go to be on the streets or causing problems, continuous problems that could easily be avoided pretty much. But yeah, I continuously wear a mask every day.
And you didn't have a kind of typical education experience, did you, Rachel?
No, I did not. I was homeschooled from the age of 10 because of how the school system failed me. Because the school system was like, oh, we'll bump you up several grades or whatever. And I had thankfully had one good teacher. And that's what I also worry, is that kids are always going to be known as the naughty kid, because that's what I was always told. I was the naughty one, the misbehaved one, where in actuality, it was me screaming out for help. Yes, I may have banged my head on the floor. I may have tried to climb out the window and said some things that I shouldn't have done. But that was me screaming for help. And I don't want to get back to that dark, dark place pretty much. So I want to help other children not get to that point.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm really sorry. It sounds so challenging. And and what you've touched on is in school, people not making allowances, including professionals. And I assume that comes down to them not understanding the condition or not recognising it. And yes. Sandy, I want to come back to you because I know FASD is sometimes called a hidden disability because it often goes undiagnosed or is misdiagnosed. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes. So as I mentioned earlier, that study that was done by the University of Salford, when they went into classrooms and they just assessed, and it wasn't even the full range. This is considered a conservative study because some of the children who were most at risk weren't included in the study. So they didn't go into special schools. They didn't have permission for some of the children who were looked after, things like that. But 2-4%, and none of them had prior neurodevelopmental diagnoses. That should make everybody sit up a little bit. And then there's also diagnoses tend to stop at the first one. So quite typically, somebody might have an ADHD diagnosis because it's obvious, you know, then once typical treatments for that don't work, then they move on, get an autism diagnosis, maybe. This is what happened to my son. And he's not the only one who goes down this route. But then with autism, as with ADHD, they typically don't present as, there's always something a little bit not quite the typical presentation. And it's because the origin of the problem is different. It's due to the brain damage and the way the brain's processing. So for our son, it wasn't until he had the FASD diagnosis finally, and he was between 9 and 10 when he got the diagnosis, that we really understood that he had this underlying brain damage and that we had to change everything around him and not try to keep forcing him to fit into society. We just didn't understand what was going on. And that's a lot of years of not understanding somebody. And as Rachel's been saying, you know, the impact on the child and the further trauma that we're giving young people by not understanding what's going on with them is really heartbreaking. There's hope. The current diagnostic guidelines now, it's called SIGN 156, and it's in effect across Scotland, England, and Wales. And it says that prenatal alcohol exposure should be actively considered as a possible underlying cause for neurodevelopmental delay. So it's meant to flip that on its head so that we don't wait and think of it as the last thing, but that when there's a young person or even indeed an adult, but when somebody's presenting with neurodevelopmental delay, we ask that question, is it possible it was an alcohol-exposed pregnancy?
And can you say more about why a correct diagnosis is so important? What happens once that diagnosis is made? What support and interventions are offered?
Well, I'd like to say that it instantly opens up to a pathway of support. It doesn't entirely yet, but there's first of all, what happens is the young person and the family supporting that young person can understand, as Rachel was saying, that this isn't a young person. And I remember there was a day when we were working with an educational psychologist. I remember I was describing to her some of the behaviors that were going on in the home. This is before the diagnosis. And she looked at me and she said, I think this was, you know, hitting and kicking, spitting and doors being kicked in and things being, and she looked at me and she said, why do you assume intentionality? And up until that, I will never forget that feeling that suddenly it had never dawned on me. Kids, I have an older son who, you know, doesn't have FASD. But it had never occurred to me that some of these behaviors weren't intentional. So it helps, a diagnosis helps the young person and the family. And we've heard from other people kind of say that removes the parents, remove this guilt. And even adults who get their diagnosis as adults, they say that suddenly it helps put everything into perspective for them, that they weren't just not trying hard enough, things like that. On the other side of things, now with some developments that have happened, especially in England with the NICE quality standard on FASD, there's meant to be continuing support that kids with FASD they're meant to have neurodevelopmental assessments, which can identify the specific areas where these young people are studying. If they get a proper sensory integration assessment, we can identify exactly where that processing is going wrong with that sensory input and how they can be better supported in speech and language. If we know what's happening, especially with receptive language and things like that, we can understand better how, what kind of supports they need, not just at school, but also at school, at work, and home. And these are lifelong strategies that can really help them. So it's, to me, a diagnosis opens the door to the right kind of support, FASD-informed support. And that includes, you know, once my son had his diagnosis and he went to a specialist school eventually, and even at the specialist school, lovely as they were, they didn't understand FASD there. They were used to dealing with primarily with autistic children, and we had to work with them so they could understand better what FASD-informed strategies are. So there is help. It's just, I think it's really important that we understand the FASD, and that's why we've done the Me and My FASD resources that Rachel and others with FASD helped us with. And it's to try to focus on positive behavior support, trying to highlight peer-to-peer strategies, because Rachel can tell you, I mean, she's helped me understand how to support my child because she's been through it. You know, the people with lived experience are the ones who can show us what helps them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to know that people with FASD can and do achieve. We've started a new magazine that we call Living FASD, and in it we feature different successes for people with FASD. And that can be everything from getting gold at the Special Olympics to learning how to swim. You know, there's all kinds of things that are challenges and successes in the lives of people with FASD.
And just for our listeners, are there any particular websites so if people want to look at those resources or find resources?
The one that's designed for children and young people with FASD is www.fasd.me. National FASD's website is nationalfasd.org.uk. And we have lots of information on there for practitioners, as well as for adults with FASD and for families.
Great. Thank you. Rachel, I want to return to you because we've been talking about diagnosis. How did you get diagnosed and what support have you received since your diagnosis?
I was diagnosed when I was 6, and about 14 years ago, there wasn't really a lot of information because I was just told, oh, by the way, you have this massive label on top of your head, but we don't know how to help you with that. It was more different for me than it would be for someone now. Mm-hmm. You know, if I didn't have my adoptive parents or my rest of my family, I wouldn't be where I am today if it weren't for them, you know, because it was really hard. I was just basically treated like a normal child that was just misbehaving. Even though I had 4 other siblings with the same diagnosis, I still felt alone. I felt alone because it's mm-hmm. like impacts people with the condition differently. It's mm-hmm. like you as unique as a fingerprint, pretty much. I didn't really understand my condition till I was 14. Until I think that's when I first met Sandy. With the whole diagnosis and everything, I went into a dark place where it was just, I felt like I was, like I said, on my own. And I looked like this alien because I knew I was different from all the other kids. How I used to cope with it was talking to myself. I still do that to this day, really. But I would always be told, hush, hush. And I would be picked on because I did feel like if a person on my own, just having a million eyes on me, and that just, you know, affected me, and not just me, my family, but yeah, I didn't have a lot of support other than, you know, social workers not understanding my condition either was really terrible, because I also had, I think it was an ADHD or an autistic diagnosis as well. They were like, oh, we could put this in place for you, but we don't know if that's going to help you. I basically had to, in a way, fight the battle on my own until I said, like I said, until I was 14.
So you had the diagnosis, but the professionals hadn't caught up really. But why is it important, would you say, Rachel, for someone with FSD to understand their own diagnosis?
I had this whole diagnosis slapped on me, and it was just like I was just left to figure out on my own what it was. Like I said, it put me into a dark place, and I don't want that happening to another child, because I know how horrible it is to have no one really talk to you about it. If my parents or social workers or the doctor that diagnosed me sat me down and said, okay, so these are the problems you're going to have for the rest of your life, but we are here for you, that's where I'm like, I wished I had someone to go confide in, say, you're not alone, I'm here. Because I just feel like if you don't have that diagnosis, that can make people do some horrible things, because we've always been told, you're a naughty kid, you're doing this for attention seeking. And to be honest, we're not. Because we can tell, you know, oh, I'm different from this person, or I'm different from that person. If I understood back then, like, yeah, okay, fine, I'm different, but it makes me who I am. And I think that is important, just to say, it is who you are, but we are here for you and we love you.
People with FASD in the UK have created a manifesto setting out how they would like doctors, teachers, parents and others to better support people with FASD. Can you tell us about the manifesto and highlight some of its most important messages?
People with FASD from all across the UK wrote into us and talked with us about what would help them, because their voice is the one that's been missing too much in these discussions. So it has 15 points to it. It's everything from listen to us, speak slowly and calmly, be kind, keep things simple, be patient, understand why things are harder for us, know our brains are different and sometimes we don't get it, treat us with the same respect as others. That's one that I know Rachel was, help us to shine brighter, keep things upbeat, remember our difficulties are lifelong, don't try, do, and learn more about FASD and never give up on us. Those are the main points. And Rachel was part of a group of young people with FASD who launched this at a national conference that happened last March. But Rachel, I think some of those things are quite important to you, aren't they?
Yes, definitely.
And do you think it's important that you're treated with the same respect as other people?
100%. You know, we're just human. It's segregating us from who everyone else is. It's not fair, pretty much.
And you said earlier about, you know, the remembering that difficulties are lifelong. You said that as a young adult, that's something that's starting to concern you, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is. Because I still don't really understand everything, and it will take me longer than an average person to understand, because I'm worried about housing when I'm older and getting a job, because I've had my traumas and I get tired a lot. Course a lot quicker.
I guess the big point about the manifesto is that you want people to talk with you about your condition, right?
Oh yes, take their time, because the best way you're going to learn is by a person with the brain damage.
Thank you, Rachel. Sandy, just following on from what Rachel has described, what is your message to CAM professionals? What changes might they want to make, and what should they take from our conversation today?
I think the most important thing is to understand that how it's been up to this point isn't how it's going to be moving forward with regard to FASD. It's been not very prevalent or prominent and high on people's minds up to this point. And, you know, I understand that the services are overwhelmed and overburdened and underfunded and all of that. We get that. But the thing is that people with FASD are already in the systems. They're just frustrating themselves and everybody else, because the kind of support that they're getting isn't FASD-informed support. So now we've got all major public health bodies are saying FASD is real, it matters, people with FASD have a right to diagnosis and support. And government says that in England, NHS has a legal duty to take these quality standards into account when they're designing services. So things are going to change. The NICE quality standard calls for more training. So we would hope that CAMS professionals and others will do more to train up. Some of the studies show that more than 90% of the people with FASD have mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard one to know what comes first, but there hasn't been enough research done yet to know, but I would bet anything that if people with FASD were diagnosed earlier, had the right kind of support in place, that figure would go way down. Because people with FASD can live happy, productive lives if they have the right kind of scaffolding around them. So I'd say the key message is that we can literally change lives by helping to recognize and support people with FASD. And it's really encouraging that the Royal College of Psychiatrists now has a working group that's looking to produce a report on FASD. So hopefully that's going to be another exciting milestone and further step in the field. I know of people who have had professionals say to them that, oh, FASD is not real. Now there's less ground for them to say that now that finally, because it's been so silent up there in the from the Department of Health and NHS and everything, you know, previously. But this is in the last couple of years. This has all changed. The people are in the systems already, but it's just not working. And if we can get in place the right support, I think everybody will be happier. It'll cost less money. You know, how much money does it cost for a young person once they are in jail or they're, you know, going through some of the horrible life experiences that hopefully we could avoid?
And Sandy, sticking with you, what about policymakers? You've said that some change is afoot. What is your message to them?
So my big question is, why is there no funding for FASD? There was a little bit of funding a couple of years ago. It's all dried up. You know, the government, they've got a new policy coming out on major conditions. And one of those major conditions is mental health. National FASD would argue that there's no way you're going to be able to meet the nation's mental health needs if you don't diagnose and properly support people with FASD. We'd like to see a parliamentary green paper, because across all the different public health bodies, there's been hundreds and hundreds of hours put into coming up with these new policies, and that there's an FASD health needs assessment that talks about where improvements need to be done. And it just seems like it would be tragic to lose that momentum by not taking the next step. But as I said, it's just acknowledging that there is best practice out there. National FASD had a whole series of roundtables with a wide range of practitioners and experts and people with lived experience. There's a report that we did called The Time Is Now that highlights best practice, and different health bodies are using that as they're trying to move forward on neurodevelopmental pathways, getting in place FASD prevention, and understanding that there are ways to do this without a huge expense to local areas that want to take steps.
Is there anything else coming up in the pipeline that you would like to mention?
The National FASD is trying to raise money right now to put in place similar materials for people as they transition into adulthood, information that's designed for them in an accessible way, maybe with some apps and some interactive websites they can use. Because, you know, my son, he's 19, and I'm sure he doesn't know how to access benefits and support and what he's entitled to. Rachel's just told us that she's concerned about what she's going to do once her parents are no longer here. We hope that's a very, very long time from now, but housing issues, all these sorts of things. We have to start preparing young people to make that transition to an adulthood in a healthy way. If you think, you know, as we said, 2 to 4% of the population, that means think of all the adults out there who are struggling, who's maybe the people who are homeless or have addiction problems or have been in prison, you know, living lives of desperation because they were never diagnosed and never appropriately supported. We want to prevent that. We want to create healthier futures. But the most important thing is that people with FASD have so many strengths. You know, the people who listen to this podcast have the ability to change lives. And I hope they know what a game changer that can be. So we went from desperate, desperate times with all kinds of things going on in our house to now our house has been calm and happy. And my son, he loves music. He's fantastic at creating music, and you know, he's kind and caring and loving. So if we can focus on the positives and switch the whole discussion, we can create better tomorrows. And Rachel and others like her are showing us how to do it by being courageous and coming forward. And it's not easy to share the kinds of things she shared today, but it's what gives us all hope and to keep moving forward.
And finally, what are your take-home messages for our listeners?
I guess just be patient with the condition. because we are a little bit slow on some things, but, and you know, we can be very loving towards people. We can show you our, like Sandy said, our strengths if you just let us.
And Sandy?
Yeah, FASD is real. There's no denying that anymore. CAMS practitioners, people in mental health services, you can really have such a powerful role in the lives that people are leading, and you can help create brighter futures. And I mean that very sincerely. The FASD UK Alliance is an informal coalition of groups all across the country. If anybody out there is looking to talk with people with FASD or to better understand, get lived experience to advise how to move forward on this, either contact National FASD or contact other groups in the FASD UK Alliance. We're out here. We're meant to be being consulted on these things. As we say, with governments putting this new push on mental health as a major condition, please talk with people with FASD and their families as you're trying to figure out ways forward, because we're an important part of the mix.
Rachel and Sandy, thank you so much for your time today. For more details on FASD and FASD Awareness Month, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review.
And do share with friends and colleagues.